So he gave a great example to visualize the Ananda Kosha, Anandamaya Kosha, child in bed pulling over the cover, seeing the darkness. Can you give another example to help in visualizing this Anandamaya Kosha? Actually, it's our deep... Yes. The question is, can you give another example to visualize the Anandamaya Kosha? One example was the child who pulls the cover over his head and opens his eyes in the darkness, is seeing the darkness in a sense. In the same way, when it's completely blank, we are seeing it. Well, let me give you an example. Swami Nishreyashanandaji, Maharaj must have seen him. I have not seen him.
I have seen him once in Belur Mathi.
Yes, I've heard about him. Yeah. He was... Oh, you have seen him? You've seen him too?
He stayed in our house.
Oh, he was the one who really developed the Vedanta movement in South Africa.
Right.
He was a disciple of Swami Shivanandaji, Mahapurush Maharaj. Hatha Yogi. So he was a real expert in yoga. But he had a way with words, it seems, so wonderful ways of explaining things. So one example he gave was of the station master. Now there's a station master in a station, and he gives the signal, and a train comes in on the platform. And in India, the prestigious train, the busy train is Rajdhani Express. So imagine the Rajdhani Express has come to the platform. And people are getting on it, people are getting off it, and it's a real busy time. You know, it's a lot of activity going on. The station master watches. And then the train pulls out. Station master did not come with the train, station master did not leave with the train. After some time, another train comes to the platform, that's a goods train, which carries freight, you know. Not much activity, maybe the driver gets down, or signal man gets down, nobody's coming or getting off, has a cup of tea and gets up on the train and leaves again. Station master did not come with this train, nor did he leave with that train, he's still watching. And now there is no train on the platform. It's empty, no train. Station master is still watching. Now he says, the busy train of our waking state, Jagrat, which is this, it has come into our consciousness. Here I have a body, I have a world, I have problems, I have issues, I have things to do, struggles, fights to do. This is my Rajdhani Express. Consciousness, I the consciousness am watching. After some time, I fall asleep. The whole thing pulls out of my consciousness. And a dream world comes in. Vague, smoky, something is happening. Not in this industrial grade strength reality. This is... That is more vague. Consciousness still watches. The station master is watching. That pulls out. Dreams stop. And nothing. Consciousness is still watching. This consciousness, watching the empty platform, that's the witness of our Anandamaya Kosha. The blankness in deep sleep. There is no activity. There is no objective activity. There the so-called subject, the ego is also not present there. It's just blankness illumined by light. Okay, I'll give you one more example. And this is from St. John of the Cross, a Christian mystic. He gives one beautiful example. He says, the darkness of space is actually filled with light. It's true. Deep space, when the sun radiates light, if you have a comet or a spacecraft passing through it, it will reflect that light. Otherwise, if you have nothing in space, just the vacuum of space, then the light streaming from the sun, coming towards the earth, that path is full of light because light is that all that light is coming through it. But you don't see anything. You don't see anything, nor do you see that light. To see the light, you must have something to reflect it off. In the same way, to appreciate consciousness, you must have something to reflect it off. In deep sleep, in the causal state, the Anandamaya Kosha is like dark space filled with light. Consciousness is fully there, but there's nothing to be aware of. What is the fundamental smallest unit of karma, building block of karma? I've never thought about it that way. Karma is, you know, what is law of karma? I remember when I was teaching once in the training center, the Brahmacharis, they ask all sorts of questions, which is good, which makes me think. One of them asked, where does this law of karma come from? Oh, I said, it is in Gita, it's in the Upanishads. I started giving references. He said, no, I'm not asking for references. The very concept, where does it come from? I thought about it. And I came to a very interesting understanding. You know where it comes from? Law of karma is nothing but causality. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. And causality is accepted by everybody. Our whole of science is based on causality. If something is happening, there must be a cause for it. If the cause comes, the effect must come. If the effect is seen, then the cause must be there. Causality. Cause and effect. Now when we apply it to our lives as we experience it, is it with cause or without cause? You have to admit that if you do not admit the law of karma, if you do not admit causality, then you have to say our life is meaningless. You have to say that our life is meaningless. To say that life has, there is some link, some explanation, you have to admit the law of karma. So law of karma comes from our basic understanding of causality. And even birds and animals understand causality. I mean, they operate on that. If I peck that place and honey will come out. They know. In the same way, whatever we experience in life must have a cause. And if we set the cause into motion, it must give rise to an effect. So that's the law of causality. And that's developed into the law of karma. That is why it's so universally accepted in Indian philosophy. The others, they have so many views about what is real and what is false. What is the nature of God? There's so many views. Dualism, non-dualism, qualified non-dualism. Buddhism has its own take. Very different from Hindu approach. But once Swami pointed out that Buddhism, Hinduism, all schools, they uniformly accept the law of karma and reincarnation. So basic building block of karma, I cannot say, but definitely it is causality, cause and effect.
Even it is accepted in Christianity. For example, you read that as you sow, so you reap. It is same thing actually,
yes.
Cause and effect.
Just the language is different, but yes. it's cause and effect.
So there is that question, you know, that what is the unit of karma?
Uh-huh. And karma, as far as I can say, the basic idea is that this is causality. And if you want to delve deeper into it, we speak of Sanchita Karma, Agami Karma, and Prarabdha Karma. Now, Sanchita Karma is all the storehouse, our entire account of karma, good and bad, which is stored up, not yet giving results. We don't know. Agami is that which will give rise to effects later on, in the next birth. And Prarabdha Karma is that which has already started giving effects. What effects? What we are seeing in our lives. Many things happen to us beyond our calculation. One thing you'll notice, if you ask people, everybody, just about everybody will say our life has not gone the way we thought it would. Some things we calculated and came about, but most of the things, both good and bad, is beyond our thought. Many things we got, they'll say, I got much more than I deserve. Or we see people suffering without seeing any cause, apparent cause of suffering. So that is Prarabdha Karma. That which has already started giving effects. And it will go on. As long as this body lasts, it will go on giving effects. So this is the way in which we divide karma. Now this karma, whether it is in units or not, like kilograms or meters, can we measure it or not? I'm not. That is the way. But yes, if you want a more detailed analysis, I don't know the details, but little bit I remember only from my studies of Jainism. Jains have a very well developed theory of karma. Jainism, if you are familiar, it's a they are very small in number. It's a religion in India. It's actually older than Buddhism. The last of the known founders of Jainism is Mahavira. He's the last of the 24 Tirthankaras. And he is an elder contemporary of Buddha, lived maybe just before the Buddha lived. So that's at least 2,500 years old. But if you go to Parshvanath and other Tirthankaras, you go back thousands of years before that. And the Jains are a small sect, somewhat like Buddhism. And they have a very highly developed theory of karma. Because they say whatever is happening to us is karma. And they have an idea of karma particles. That might be of interest to the person who has asked this. I used to joke and call them karmions. They say that karma is actually a kind of matter which sticks to the soul, to the self, good and bad. And the thicker your layer of karma, the more caught you are in this world. Now the way to get out of it is to get rid of karma. And to get rid of karma, you can do two things. One is don't accumulate more karma. So they are very heavily monastic. They tend to renounce the world. There are famous incidents, famous cases in India, even now. They are a very rich group. They are traders. Many of them are diamond merchants and all. And every now and then, one young person who is a multimillionaire will renounce everything. And by that, everything, every little bit of possession, down to your clothes also. So they'll renounce everything and become a wandering monk, a Jain bhikshu. So that you don't accumulate any further karma. Now how do you remove the karma which is already there? All the particles of karma which is sticking to your soul. So the removal is that by suffering the effects. The more you suffer, the more karma is removed. So they undergo very strict austerities regarding food, sleep. We invited one very senior Jain teacher, Acharya Mahapragya, who passed away recently in Rajasthan. We invited him to give a talk in our Institute of Culture in Gold Park in Calcutta. Now, if you know Indian geography, Rajasthan is on the western side of India and Calcutta on the eastern side. When we invited him, he replied sweetly. A letter came saying that the Acharya would be happy to speak, but you should have invited him a few years ago. Why? Because he will walk across India, let alone fly. He will not take a train, he will not take a vehicle, he'll walk across India. There are so many Jain monks who still walk across India. And I saw, they have a meeting of Jain monks. I saw the agenda, recent agenda. One of the agendas is roadkill. There are too many Jain monks getting run over by vehicles, so they're thinking about what to do. So they are extremely austere. So if you're more austere you are, the more you torture yourself and you suffer, the more your karma is getting exhausted. So they have a very highly developed theory of karma. I am consciousness, so I am not the karma that is appearing in this through this body. Then how does pure consciousness mix with karma and give rise to ego, which I call I? What happens after realization? Does karma vanish? All are very good questions. Or consciousness and karma disentangle, removing the I feeling? Yes, you are consciousness. I am happy that you are claiming it. You know, the problem is, you say, okay, I have understood. My Atman is pure consciousness. You are pure consciousness. Atman means you, the self. How do you get entangled with the body and karma? How do they mix? How does subject and object mix? Knowingly or unknowingly, you have asked the crucial question. Subject and object, how do they mix? The answer is they do not. What do you mean? Here I am mixed. The answer is only apparently so. How does this light there, reflecting on this paper, how does light and paper mix? Well, they have not mixed. Light is reflecting a paper and making you aware of the paper. You can see the paper. But if I keep the paper, if I twist the paper, if I write something on the paper, if I soak the paper, if I burn the paper, light has nothing to do with it. It goes on illuminating. If I remove the paper, you cannot see the paper. Light is still there. Similarly, consciousness actually is not involved with the body, mind. You see, we are always involved. It only seems to be that way. To some extent, light and paper are interacting, because if you are a physics student, you will tell me that ultimately light is photons. It is bouncing off the paper in some way. Bouncing may not be the right word to use. I can see physics students tearing their hair. But they are interacting. True, they interact because both are material. This is a material light which is coming from the bulb. And this is matter. And matter and matter can interact. Energy and matter can interact. They interact because they are all material. But how can spirit and matter interact? Two entirely different things can never interact. Can never interact. And yet they appear to interact all the time. When? Just now. You are there. You are listening to me. It's consciousness plus body and mind. How does this, what is this plus then? If you have heard my Drigdrishya Viveka talks, in I think the second talk, I spoke about three relations. Three crucial relations. Catch hold of the I. I means the I which you are feeling right now, the ego. The ego which you are feeling right now. This ego is related to three things. One, body. Because you say, I am this, so ego is related to the body. I, don't think about any kind of very high metaphysics, just the I which we are feeling now. I am this body, we say that. So I is somehow related to this body. And I is somehow related to consciousness, because I always, whenever I think of I, it's a conscious I. Whenever the I comes, there's a consciousness there in the I. And the I is somehow related to the real pure consciousness, which is the witness, Atman, Brahman, what you call it. That's what Vedanta says. We don't understand it now. But Vedanta says that you are really that. So in some sense, the I must be related to my real I. So three relations. I related to body, deha. I related to the reflected consciousness, consciousness which is in the I feeling right now. It's called reflected consciousness, the awareness which is there in the right I feeling. Why do you call it reflected consciousness? Because when the I feeling is not there, the I thought is not there, there is a time, like when we go to deep sleep, even that I feeling goes away. So that consciousness also goes away. We feel we are unconscious. But the pure consciousness still remains. So I related to body, I related to reflected consciousness, I related to pure consciousness. What you asked, how does the I consciousness interact with body? Now, these three, what are the nature of these three relationships? I am related to the body, Vedanta says, because of my past karma, prarabdha karma. As long as this body lasts, the I feeling in the body will say, I am this body. I am this body. As long as this body lasts. Even for an enlightened soul, when he says I, he will mean this body. Secondary, I'll come to that later. So that I feeling is related to the body as long as the body lasts. How long will this body last? When the body dies, when prarabdha karma is exhausted, this body will die. Then the I feeling will be associated with another new body. A baby will feel that I, not this body. You can take it away and burn it or bury it or whatever. It doesn't feel that. So I is related to the body only by karma. At the death of the body, the I will no longer be related to this body. One. I is related to consciousness. Why does this I feel conscious? Because the I can reflect consciousness. You is just like a mirror and your face. Now the mirror will have a reflected face. Your real face is pure consciousness. The reflected face is the reflected consciousness in the I. The mirror is the I. By here, I hope you understand. It means the vertical I, not this I. In the mirror of the I, consciousness is reflected. That's why the mirror, whenever you take up the mirror will appear with a reflected face. That face doesn't belong to the mirror. It's reflected there because the real face is being reflected. And the interesting thing is you can only see the reflected face. You cannot see the real face. You can only experience the reflected consciousness. You, the pure consciousness, the tenth man, you don't experience it as an object. The consciousness which we feel right now is the consciousness reflected in the I. So always I feels conscious. What is this relation? It says a natural relation. As long as there is a mirror, there will be a reflection. Cover up the mirror, no reflection. As long as there is an I, there will be a conscious I. Shut off the I, switch off the I, unconscious, deep sleep, there is no feeling of consciousness also. No reflected consciousness. The reflected face disappears. Now our mistake is to think that the real face is also gone. We don't make that mistake because we know. My face is reflected there. If it's not reflected there also, my face is there. Exactly as it was. But in the case of consciousness, we make a mistake. We think consciousness in the I is the real consciousness. And when the I is not there, there is no consciousness and I am unconscious. But there actually only consciousness is there, nothing to reflect that consciousness. So I and consciousness, they say sahajam, natural relationship. Whenever the mirror is there, reflection will be there. Whenever I is there, it will be a conscious I. And finally, the real thing, what your question was, what is the connection between consciousness and the I? And they say, Bhranti Janyam. There is no connection. They say in Hindi, Bewkufi. Our foolishness is the only connection. Your face has no connection with the mirror or with the reflected face. You can smash the mirror, the reflection will be smashed. Reflection will disappear. Nothing will affect your real face. In the same way, whatever happens in the world, in the mind, it's happening because of the pure consciousness, but the pure consciousness is not affected by it. So there is no real relationship between you, no real, I'll underline the real, but there is an apparent relationship by which we are deluded. The whole world, all of us are working, doing everything, even coming to Vedanta class, because of that apparent mixing up of consciousness and non-conscious matter, mind. Shankaracharya, there is introduction to Brahma Sutra. I mentioned Brahma Sutra. Shankaracharya's famous introduction to Brahma Sutra. If there is one profound piece of scripture, one professor told me, Professor J.N. Mahanti, he told me, he's a master of both Western philosophy, phenomenology, and also Vedanta. This professor told me, in reading all the scriptures of the East and the West, philosophical literature of the East and the West, I have not come across a more profound sentence than the opening sentence of Shankaracharya's introduction, Adhyasa Bhashya, introductory sentence to the Brahma Sutras. One sentence. And what is that sentence? Exactly this question. He says, I and you, or I and that. Let's say I and that. Subject and object. The pure subject, consciousness and object, including mind and everything. They are entirely different. Tamap prakashavad, like light and darkness. They can never mix. They can never mix. And yet in every movement of life they appear to mix. Because we feel we are conscious beings, thinking, willing, talking. Thinking, willing, talking, everything is with the mind and body. Consciousness, he says, is separate from them. And yet they are mixing every time. And then he says, if something that is impossible and yet it seems to happen, here is the fun. If something is impossible, yet it seems to happen, mithya iti bhavitum yuktam, he says, it must be false. It does not exist. It only appears to exist like a rope, like a snake in a rope. The snake in the rope, you cannot drive it away with a stick because it's not a real snake. You can only drive it away by realizing it's a rope, not a snake. You can drive away this apparent mixture, this false mixture of consciousness and non-consciousness by realizing there is no mixture at all. It's like somewhat like light and paper interacting here. They don't mix in the same way. So that is the first opening theme. That's the first sentence of Brahma Sutra, the commentary on Brahma. You can imagine what it's like. So because this mixture is false, on this crucial sentence, entire non-dual Vedanta, entire Advaita Vedanta, Shankaracharya's works, interpretations of Upanishad, Gita, the non-dual part of Hinduism, our Vedanta society, we are sitting here, all of it stands on that one sentence. Because if that is true, then it's a confusion, it's an error, like seeing a snake in a rope. An error is corrected by only knowledge. False thing is corrected by truth. Real snake you have to drive away with a stick. A false snake only you need to realize it's a rope. In the same way, the path of knowledge works. Jnana Yoga, Advaita Vedanta, it works only because this mixture is false. If you were really, really something trapped in a body, actually, physically, then knowledge would not work. If it's a real snake, any amount of saying it's a rope, it will not work, it will bite you. In the same way, if you are really a body and a mind, no amount of thinking, I am consciousness, I am Brahman, no amount of singing, Chidananda, Rupa, Shivoham, will help. No. When the body dies, that's it, finished. It's only because of this. And he looks at it not from any kind of blind belief, not kind of in doctrine, philosophically looking at our experience, day-to-day. He says, samsara can continue because of this error. When you correct this error, what will happen? Will consciousness and matter separate? No, everything will go on as it is. Absolutely no problem. But you as consciousness, you are free of the travails of matter.
That was a wonderful explanation. And then the second sentence of this very Adhyasa Bhashya answers the other part of this question, that how psychologically it affects us, as he was telling, that because of this superimposition, we keep on saying I and mine, idam mama. And this is mama idam. It is natural, naisargikoyam lokavyavharaha. That is why we keep on saying I and mine, our whole life is based on this error. And as this error goes, what happens? One of the Swamis who was teaching us this thing, he told, then see Sri Ramakrishna, that it is that for that person, there is no I to be found. No I and mine. It is thou and thou alone. That is the life of Sri Ramakrishna. And so he added there, naisargikoyam lokavyavharaha, for the one who has known this or realized this truth, naisargikoyam buddhavyavharaha. Yeah, that it is. That Maharaj was Bhaskareshwarananda. Naisargikoyam buddhavyavharaha. That this is the nature, natural behavior of a person of knowledge, that nothing, no I, no mine. So that is how the whole scene changes with the knowledge.
Now, as Maharaj said, but suppose somebody asks, Sri Ramakrishna also said, Jal khabo, I'll drink a glass of water, my hand is broken, or I will go there, or I will go to Calcutta. He's clearly saying, I means this body. So what's happening here? In Panchadashi it is said, I, the word I, today we're talking about shifting the meaning of the I. The word I is used in three senses. In three senses. In one way by the Ajnani, the ignorant, us. And in two ways by the Jnani, by the enlightened person. What is the one way in which we use it? We use it in a simple and direct way. I means this body and mind. That's all. That's one sense. The other two senses in which are the senses in which the enlightened person uses. First of all, the primary sense, mukhyartha, the enlightened person knows I means Brahman, pure consciousness, existence, consciousness, please. For the enlightened person, Chidananda Rupaha Shivoham. Aham, I am existence, consciousness, bliss. I am the very essence of Shiva. And Sri Ramakrishna knows that. An enlightened person knows that. But here is the funny thing. The second sense in which they use the word I, in the Panchadashi it's mentioned, is to interact with us. Loka Vyavahara. So they pretend as if the I refers to this body, so that it makes it easy for them, because Sri Ramakrishna used to use it in two senses. Once he was, sometimes he would say, my hand is broken, or I have a pain here, I am going to Calcutta, referring to this body as himself, the secondary sense. Sometimes he would refer to the body as this. When you come, bring something for this. This will be worshipped in times to come. Not I. This will be worshipped in times to come. So this form. So there are the three senses in the which the word I is used. When in the chariot example, where would the ego, ahamkara fit in? Ah. We are using the chariot example to shift the ego. When it fits in with the buddhi, I, then the passenger and the buddhi are identified. You don't see them as being different. So you are the guy at the wheel. That's how we live our lives, mostly. But the shift is, when you shift the I, the ego, back from buddhi to the Atman, to the Purusha, the passenger sitting in the back seat. Now, this shift changes the ego, the ahankara, from to the Shuddha Aham. Ahamkara is the ego. Have you noticed one funny thing? When Shankaracharya sings in that Mano Buddhi Ahamkara Chittani Naham, have you noticed the language there? You can say, I am not the mind. Mana na aham. Buddhi na aham. I am not the intellect. Chitta na aham. I am not the memory, mind stuff. Ahankara na aham. I am not the I. What a funny use of language. I am not I. The same I, the vertical I. I am not the I. What does he mean? He means the pure I is not the ego. The ego is an object. Just like this is an object, the ego is an object.
Continue.
Okay. It's a very interesting thing. It should take a few minutes. I want to show you an exercise which I found by a psychologist, a British psychologist, Jeffrey Good, I think. He's interested in Advaita. He has developed a psychological exercise. Would you like to experience, it's a little scary. Would you like to experience your ego as an object like this?
Yeah.
Yes. So direct experience. But it was very, very, very interesting. A little scary also. Because you'll... you know, it's not Halloween scary, but it is actually something internal. So, all right. Now, what you do is, you sit straight, and mentally, the idea is to find out the I, to see the I as an object. Is it an object or is it me? I am the subject. But you are saying that, no, I am not the subject. The I you are feeling is an object. Let's see. Mentally draw a line, a parallel line through your waist, mentally. Line parallel to the ground. So you have divided your body, upper half, lower half. Now say to yourself, I, mentally. Where would you locate the I? In the lower half of the body or up in the upper half? Where would you feel the I is? Almost everybody. Very funny person will say, no, I feel it in the knee. I feel it in the upper half of the body. I do at least. So most of us do. Very good. Draw another line. Keep your eyes open. Look at me. Draw another line mentally through your chest here. Dividing your body into above the chest and below the chest. You said your eye is in the upper half of the body. Now above the chest, below the chest, where would you put the eye? Above or below?
Above.
Yes. Mostly we would feel above. Now go further. Draw a line through the parallel to the ground. Below the neck, whole body, above the neck. Where would you put the I? We normally put the I feel the I am somewhere here in the head, not below. Alright. Somewhere in the head. Now, draw two vertical lines. One line through this part of the head, one line through this part of the head. Yeah? Above through the eyes, straight down. This part of the head, middle of the head. Now, where would you put the I? This part, that part, or the middle? Think about it. Some will say nowhere, somewhere there. Some will say, mostly will say in the middle. In the middle. And if you push it further, you will find it's somewhere here, forehead, vaguely, and behind. Some people even say it's like a ball or like something a feeling behind, I, something vague feeling, I just stay there. See now, who is watching that I? You can never catch it. You have already seen it as an object. Do you realize what you have done? The I, you have located it as some kind of a feeling and emerging from somewhere here, in the middle of the head. Clearly an object of consciousness. The I is a thought which you can actually physically locate. As much as you can locate your hand and your nose and ears, in a subtle way, somewhere you get a feeling of the I emerging from there. And there are neuroscience reasons why we feel, because of the high concentration of nerves and feeling in the face and the head, that's why you feel it there. But the fact is, you feel it as an object. You are that which is feeling the I as an object somewhere here. So the I is reduced to an object, you are the observer of the I. Ahankaranaham, Shankaracharya says, I am not the I. The I which is at the root of everything. Everything is done in life for that I. That's an object. As much as your nose is, that's an object. That which is observing the I, that is elusive. You can never catch it. That's your real sense. If you draw a line right down the middle, very difficult to find out. You will feel, depending on your focus feeling on your right or the left, you will feel it somewhere. Maybe vaguely here or somewhere. You might feel it. But the point is not to feel it this way or that. Where it is, it's not a point. The point is, it is an object. Somewhere it is. If you objectivize the eye, then what is the subject? Who is watching the eye? That's the real eye, and that can never be objectified. Your problem, practice, result from Advaita, that problems and practice and result. Problem, practice, result makes a lot of sense. Not mine, it is entirely Shankaracharya's. My question is about the stage before this, the readiness for beginning spiritual practice. Could you suggest concrete steps for this preparatory phase? These are all preparations. Don't worry about the stage before this. You have already crossed that stage, congratulations. The very fact that you are here is you have crossed that stage. What is the stage before this? Very in the very brief, where you have no question about this. You are happy with the world, or terribly unhappy with the world, you are engrossed in it. The happiness of the world or the misery of the world is your only reality. You are not interested in anything beyond that. If anybody promises something, okay. The misery of the world. If somebody promises something beyond this also, you discount it. You will say either it's not true, it's just make-believe. Or you will say it's true, but it's too difficult for me. Or it's true, but I'll do it when I'm retired, not now. The very fact that we are here means we have come to this preliminary stage. We start with Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Dhyana, Raja Yoga and Jnana Yoga. All four we are ready to start. Ramana Maharshi, it seems, used to say, somebody asked him, am I qualified for Advaita? Am I qualified for spiritual life? And he said, did you say I? Because his method was, who am I? If you say I, you are qualified. You have got an I. You are qualified. You can always inquire, who am I? Arjuna and Duryodhana represent probably the two extremes of individuals recognizing right and wrong and their willingness to change. Most of us in the middle path, sometimes recognizing, sometimes willing to change. Any spiritual guidance for these middle pathers, Maharaj?
Every time when we represent the two extreme categories, then just to say that one can be somewhere in the middle. Nobody is exactly Duryodhana, nobody is exactly the other one, the Arjuna. We all, sometimes we feel, well, although I know this is good, my tendency is not to do it. And we go along that which we know that it is not good, and yet we go to do that. But then many times we don't do. When we see that it is not right, and even though I like it, I check my liking. When I see the overwhelming loss that I will be subjected to by following my liking, and then I desist from doing it. So this happens, you know, many people who are, say, diabetic. They're not that they don't like sugars, they like, In fact, at Belur Math, I was told that that is the sign you can tell who is diabetic. You know the what was told, that look, when in the whole line sitting for the meals, everybody is being served one piece of sweet. When the bucket comes in front of this diabetic, he says, "Oh, don't give me more than two." So that is a sure sign that the person is diabetic. So there is an attempt, you know, to control. It is, although there is, because the liking for sugar is another sign of being diabetic. So, but this person sees what bad effects may come because of this and tries to control. Some can, some cannot, because they do not have that strong discrimination like Arjuna, that yes, or Nachiketa for that example, and that yes, this is not right, and then question doesn't come at all whether it is pleasant or unpleasant. That it is not right, I don't want it. For some, well, it is pleasant, and that is with so many, you know, that what is the reason that you are doing it? Well, I like it, as if it is reason sufficient. So, these are the extremes, but you see many that although they like it, they won't do it because they know it is not right. That there is my exam tomorrow and that there is this big ball game going on. I like to watch, but tomorrow is my test. So that person resists it because you decide on those lines what is right, what is not right. So we are in the middle, and our becoming a spiritual aspirant is to increase this more and more. This is actually where our human nature comes in. As human beings, we have that faculty of reason. Like Aristotle says, that is where our humanity lies. That it is, we reason and see what effects will come of this action. And thus, if it is not right, even though the action looks pleasant, since the effect is not going to be right, I will not do it. So this is the progress on spiritual path, that as we imbibe this character more and more, not to guide our actions by likes and dislikes, but by right and not right.
My question is not directly related to Katha Upanishad, but it is related to the Upanishads. In the language of paradoxes, what is the meaning of neti neti? Very briefly, neti neti you find in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, esha neti neti atma. This way, I'll just compress it in a couple of sentences. Neti neti means not this, not this, not what. Not this means that it is none of the objects of this world. Anything that you may bring up, atman, the self, is it the body? No. Is it the vital sheath? No. The mental sheath? No. Is it the intellectual sheath? No. Not this, not this, not this. Then at one point it will come to this, you know, that then it doesn't exist. Non-existent. Not this, not that too. And stop. How to put into practice what you have taught without losing the focus energy that we have got today? Any day-to-day tips? It is true that inevitably we run out of steam, and very quickly. So the day-to-day tips, best way is, we have a system in Hinduism called Sankalpa, where you make a commitment. So for example, taking a mantra is a commitment. And you go to Guru and say, I want a mantra. And the Guru gives you a mantra. It's a lifelong commitment. Whether I like it or not, whether I have a mood or not, I will do it. It's mechanical. Let it be mechanical also. But I'll do it. On a train or a plane or standing somewhere. The minimum I'll have to do. So it's that power of sankalpa, when I make a commitment, that is a very powerful thing. It may become mechanical sometimes, but it will still pull you through. Yeah. That's a powerful practice. There are several places in Kathamrita where Thakur says the path of bhakti is the best for Kali Yoga. Can you explain why your focus is most of your talks on Advaita Vedanta path of knowledge and not so much on the path of bhakti? Personally, I can only remember only two talks from you, which were on bhakti and they were wonderful. But guilty as charged. Now, my thing is, see, twofold. One is, I personally like it, this particular path. So, it's a good practice for me to study and teach this. One. And in support of this, I can say, when Swami Vivekananda went to Mayavati Ashram, the last time in Himalayas. Mayavati Ashram is the name of the place. If you are, luckily it's the US, you are not well up on Indian politics. I said Mayavati Ashram in India once, and then somebody looked at me and said, Uski ashram bhi hai kya? She is a politician there. A big. So, they say, so you are all disciples, her disciples. So she has an ashram? No, not the person, not the politician. It's a place. And then Swami Vivekananda established for the practice of non-dualism. He established the place for the practice of non-dualism. When he went there for the last time in his life, he saw the picture of Sri Ramakrishna being worshipped there. And he said, oh, the old man has entered here too. And he said, it should be removed. And the Swami who had done it was hurt naturally. And he wrote, I forget his name, he wrote to
Holy Mother.
But I forget his name, I think Vimalananda or somebody. He wrote to Holy Mother. And that we put the picture of Sri Ramakrishna, we worshipped him, and Naren, Vivekananda has come and removed it. Is this good? Is this right? And he expected support from her, because he was worshipping Sri Ramakrishna. She wrote back in no uncertain terms. She said, your guru was Advaita. Your guru was non-dual. She doesn't say your guru was a non-dualist. She says, your guru was non-dual. And therefore, you are all non-dualists. I can say this with all certainty. What Vivekananda has done, Naren has done, is correct. He's right. For that place. So there is a support there too. We are fundamentally, we are all non-dualists. But not fundamentalists. We are non-dualists in a very liberal way. On the basis of Advaita, our liberalism is grounded on Advaita, on non-dualism. So bhakti, definitely, definitely. One strong, one very, very radical non-dualist, not a liberal non-dualist like us, a very strict non-dualist follower of Shankara in the Himalayas was asked, somebody, a mischievous question, that is bhakti badi hai, gyan badi hai? Is bhakti greater or jnana greater? Is devotion, love of God greater or knowledge greater? Which is greater? And they're asking a person who obviously feels that the path of knowledge is greater. And his answer was, oh, bhakti is greater. They were taken aback. They expected him to say that knowledge is greater. He said, if bhakti is greater, then what about knowledge? He says, oh, knowledge. In knowledge, there is no greater or lesser. Gyan mein bada chota nahi hota.
Exactly.
When it comes to a question of greater or lesser, definitely bhakti is superior. We have no problem. And another reason I do that is, I asked the very senior Swami, the General Secretary Maharaj of the Order, in fact. I used to do the same thing in the training center, and I felt, does it harm people, what I do? And the answer was, no, it does not. Because, first of all, truth is never harmful. And second, you are part of the Ramakrishna Order, where there are so many Swamis who will inspire you beautifully on the path of bhakti. So many Swamis who will inspire you on the path of good works. So many Swamis who will inspire you to meditate, who will inspire you to harmonize all four. So, it will not do any harm. Yes, Maharaj.
Just one more point on this, that many times we imagine or think that bhakti or devotion is against non-duality or Advaita. That is not actually the case. If you see the most prominent non-dualist like Shankaracharya, how much devotion he had in his life. Those things are, you know, sometimes what happens is the destination as Advaita or non-dual and the path as non-dual, they are not exactly identical. Even a devotee goes closer and closer and closer to God. How close can that devotee go without merging, without being inseparable from God? if the devotee is going. So therefore these are the really the descriptions of different paths, but it is not the destination that is spoken of. Advaita, non-duality as a destination is beyond description. Only the path that leads to it can be spoken. And therefore there is the distinctions in the path will be there. And it doesn't mean that Sri Ramakrishna emphasized bhakti. But if you read a little closer, you will see that as he is describing bhakti, suddenly the knowledge also comes up. And as he is describing knowledge, suddenly devotion also comes up. They merge so seamlessly into each other. And what he quoted, you know, Swami Vivekananda's statement, that look, as Swami Vivekananda, people think that I am all knowledge. And Sri Ramakrishna, the old man, was all bhakti. It is not so. I am wearing the garment. My appearance is knowledge. Inside it is all bhakti. Just prick a little bit and the bhakti will come out. And with Sri Ramakrishna, just the opposite. Therefore that nice hymn he wrote about Sri Ramakrishna, that Advaya Tattva Samahita Chittam Projvala Bhakti Patavrita Vrittam, that it is the inside, it is all the knowledge of non-duality. And then outside the garment, that is of Projvala, a very shiny, beautiful cloth of devotion that is put on that. And so that is how it is not right to separate these things and thinking that this one is good and that one is not good. Yeah, why not? I mean, there is every possibility that following the path of bhakti, you will get there. You can say like that, it is without bhakti. How can you follow, you know, that unless your heart is there, you will not follow the path. It is, therefore, he explained it very nicely actually, that even those who are followers of path of knowledge, they insist that moksha karana samagriyam bhakti reva gariyasi, that amongst all the means of liberation, devotion, bhakti is the greatest one. So it is not that you will not reach there, you will reach there. There is no doubt about it.
I just remembered, I heard something from Swami Nirmuktanandaji, Upen Maharaj. He was one of the oldest monks of our order. He passed away a few years ago at the age of 104. He was a disciple of Swami Shivanandaji. Now he has passed away, I can tell it. He once went to Swami Ranganathanandaji and he used to ask, what will happen to me? Both are disciples of Swami Shivananda. Ranganathanji is the president of the order. And Upen Maharaj is a very senior monk. And both were in their 90s at that time. Upen Maharaj was in his 80s and Ranganathanji was in his 90s. What will happen to me? And Ranganathanji replied immediately, the president of the order. He replied immediately, this is your last life. I shall come again, but you don't have to come again. This is your last life. He said that. Now this Upen Maharaj, I asked him once to ask him, whether this is true, what I've heard. And when I said, did Ranganathanji say to you, I started and he completed the sentence. Yes, he said it's my last life. But he was very calm about it. Then I asked him this question, what is the relation of all the Vedanta we are reading and what our Guru has told us, Ishta Devata and Mantra? What's the relation between the two? This seems to be path of knowledge, that seems to be path of meditation and devotion. And the answer is what I want to share with you. Just the background was for letting you know who this person is. So Upen Maharaj Nirmuktanandji told me, have you not heard what Sri Ramakrishna said? Sri Ramakrishna told this to Akhandanandji and Akhandanandji told this to Nirmuktanandji. The Bengali is this. Jejar ishto shetar atma. Your ishta devata, the form of God in which you worship God, which your guru has indicated to you, is verily the Atman of the Upanishads. With the name and form, it's exactly the same thing. Only this technology, as it were, enables you to objectify it and meditate and love and repeat the name and all this. Arjuna is a particularly excellent variety of student, but yes, he is representative of all of us. That's why he has come to Krishna. How to get rid of fear and weakness? As Swamiji says, strength is life. Absolutely. The answer is there. Strength comes through the knowledge of the Atman. Atmana vindate viryam, vidyaya amritam vindate amritam. By knowledge of the Atman, one gets strength. That's real spiritual strength. Physical strength is a limit. Mental strength can be worn down by suffering. But spiritual strength is completely unaffected by the trials and tribulations, the travails of the world. How to be established in positive thinking? Lots and lots of books which will teach you that. But here what we talked about today goes beyond positive thinking. When you think of the Atman and you think of yourself as the Atman, then the mind cannot but help being positive. It cannot but be positive. Mind belongs to the Atman. When he realizes that the self behind the mind is immortal, is pure consciousness, is one with God, how can that mind not be positive? What thoughts should one keep in the forefront of the mind to reduce, eliminate the judgmental thoughts that rush out and prevent peace? Judgmental thoughts, if you think about others or their actions or their behavior, the best way is to know that God is in all of them. It's not that you alone are the Atman. Everybody else is also that Atman. If they are divinity themselves, how little right we have to judge them. So know them to be God fundamentally, deep within, and then deal with them. If you have to be harsh or if you have to be careful, protect yourself. If there are a lot of bad people in the world. Bad people in the sense that the badness is there in the samskaras, in the mind. Deeper than the samskaras is the same pure consciousness. So those you can help, help. Give them an upward push. Those we cannot help, pray for them and step away and save yourself from them. Regarding formal contemplation, when is the best time? Just when studying or thinking, or day end or before or after japa? Contemplation means mananam, thinking about this. You can go on at any time, but one thing is, the mantra and the ishta as given by the guru should not tamper with it. In computer they say firewall. So the teacher has given you a practice. The guru has given you a practice. The sacred name of God and a method of practice. Now, as I keep on attending more Vedanta classes, I get lots of new knowledge and I keep re-engineering that practice. Never ever do that. Never ever do that. Never tamper with it. That's meant to be practiced as it is. It's a black box. It's closed. You're not going to open it. So that practice should be isolated from everything else. It should go on whatever happens in your life, whatever you read, you do not read, whatever things you are enthusiastic about now, or you lose enthusiasm later on, all those things come and go. That mantra and that practice should continue without any effect. So, yes. Otherwise, mananam can go on all the time. If you love thinking about something, it's good. At least it prevents us from thinking about the world. Why mind degrades even after long spiritual practice? Are there small, organized and result-oriented steps to be established in practice, abhyasa and dispassion, vairagya? Yes, of course. Mind degrades only if we are not careful. If there is long and careful practice, Holy Mother used to say something strange. You are supposed to be fearless. But Holy Mother said, Mashada said, Jara che bhai tara che jai. If one has fear, one has victory. What does that mean? That means fear means caution on the spiritual path. As a rich person is cautious about his or her wealth, protects it. As an athlete is cautious about his or her health. As a learned person is very cautious about the books or the publications and things. In the same way, we should be cautious about our spiritual treasure, which is our spiritual practice. Then the chance of slips are less. Even if one slips, one can simply start all over again. Tell the Lord, I am sorry, I will not do it again. Be serious about that and start all over again. Does eating meat give bad karma? Also, can you accumulate good karma merits by doing good into animals? Is it only to be humans? No. You can be kindness to anybody. An animal also experiences pain. And so being kind to animals also gives good karma. Being kind to any sentient creature gives good karma. Buddhists, Dalai Lama's followers, they're even supposed to be kind to worms. But eating meat, it depends more on your culture and your background. I was in a meeting recently where a group of Tibetan lamas are going to visit a center in LA. So they are preparing for the visit. And one of the things which said in the information brochure said that the lamas eat meat. And then some of them were surprised. Some of you may be surprised. But it's not surprising. The Tibetan Buddhists are non-vegetarians. All of them, and always have been. There's no vegetables in Tibet. So, in most countries, people are non-vegetarians. Christians, almost all the Muslims are non-vegetarians. Does it mean that they cannot be spiritual? Of course they can be. But, as Swami Vivekananda said, vegetarianism is a better ideal. It's good to practice it. But it depends more on your background, what you're used to eating. That's why in the Gita, when Sri Krishna talks about food, he talks about sattvika food, rajasika food, tamasika food. But he never mentions any particular item. That this, you should eat this or eat that. No. In the case of a householder, how does one pursue his or her spiritual aspirations if the other person is not spiritually inclined? And other person, I guess you mean the partner, husband or wife. And it's a constant struggle. I guess it can be difficult.
As he mentioned, it can be difficult. And the difficulties, when we try to overcome them, that strengthens us. It is true that why should we expect? See, the spouse and you are together for a purpose. It is like a joint stock company. That you are together for certain purposes. And if one of them, like in that you are together in a partnership somewhere, now you may like golf, the other partner doesn't like golf, that doesn't break your partnership, you see. So it is like this, that if you want to pursue spiritual practice, doesn't matter really whether your wife or husband or partner likes it or doesn't like it, you have to pursue that path without worrying about it. That is, our mistake is that we try to pull the other person also on the path, and, well, one should not try to do that. It is, we are not the world teachers who are given responsibility to teach spirituality to everyone. So let us follow the path, irrespective of whether somebody else in the family follows or not. I have seen so many people who's they are the only one in the household who is following spiritual path. But the only thing that they have to be careful is that they should not try to impose their ideal on others. Because then that will boomerang on them. That the ideals of the other household members, that will come to them. So therefore, they should follow their path relentlessly without thinking whether my spouse or my other members in the household, they follow it or do not follow it.
Tendency to impose it on children. Now remember, it's good, and it's, you find it interesting, and you like being spiritual, and you naturally want your children to follow that. You see the wisdom in that. The thing is, you came to this wisdom after so much time. So, remember that it creates resentment. I've seen in many cases, children, if you force something on them, they'll resent it. And then you're spoiling a good thing. So the intelligent way of doing it is, I guess, leave good books lying around the house. Once or twice bring them to some nice meditation session or something. That's it. And if they were interested, they will take it up themselves today or tomorrow. It's good to introduce them. That much must be done. And the atmosphere in the house can count for a lot. Sixth, Valli. Of the tree whose roots grow upwards and branches grow down. Urdhva Moolam Avakshakam. Actually, it has been mentioned in Gita also. 15th chapter, at the beginning of 15th chapter. So this is actually a representation of samsara. The root of the samsara is above. Above means in Nirguna Brahman. In Saguna Brahman, but beyond that in Brahman itself. And the manifestation we see, the branches, leaves and fruits, all the flowers which we see is here in front of us. But the source is in Brahman. That's what it means. Yes, and man's life is also, our source is in the pure existence, consciousness, bliss which we are. And everything is manifested here. I feel greatly charmed and filled with wonder when I hear that I am indeed the great truth. And yeah, we also feel that. However, I find the neti-neti approach rather dry. What could be the reason? Well, because it is rather dry. That could be the reason. That's why use the harmony of four yogas is the best. Swami Vivekananda recommended path of knowledge, path of devotion, path of meditation, and path of action. You may have a tendency for a particular thing, which is good to have a balance. We have all these capacities, a cognitive capacity where we can reason and think and understand. Use it for the path of knowledge. An affective domain, ability to love, desire, want, use it for the path of bhakti. The ability to think and concentrate, meditation. And the cognitive domain where we use willpower to act, use it for the path of karma. Why not? And as we go along, we will all discover we have certain tendencies. Certain things which we like more than others, and we will end up doing those. But Swami Vivekananda's insight was, a balance is very good for spiritual life. Even if you don't like certain things, better do a little bit of that, if it's a good thing. Can and does God override karma and its fruit? Yes. That is, what we deserve, we will get. But devotion to God is something that can override or reduce bad karma, can amplify, can generate a lot of good karma. Sri Ramakrishna used an example. It's relevant only to 19th century India. He says, Ami Parashtanga. In Bengal it means, the Indian freedom fighters against the British, they would be arrested by the British police. But there was a French colony, which was the territory of France, in India. So if the freedom fighters could somehow escape across the river or the just walk across into that colony, now the British Empire couldn't catch them without risking war with France. So the French land, that Parashtanga, the shore of the French, is where the normal laws do not apply. So it's a small place, but it's somewhere, somehow it's outside the colonial empire, British Empire. So that way, when God is like that, you take refuge. As a holy mother used to say, if when a person would have lost a leg, he gets a pinprick, gets hurt, suffers, but not as much as he would have if a person takes refuge in God. I guess that itself is powerful karma, if you believe in God and surrender to God. Sri Ramakrishna tells the story of a farmer building a small wall to bring water to the field whole day, but not a drop of water came because of a small holes. Holes desired, control desire, or plug the hole. Absolutely. Sri Ramakrishna says, if we have desires which we keep on satisfying and pursuing, at the same time we do sadhana, the spiritual practice will have its effect, but that gets drained by other kinds of activities. So the more one-pointed we are, that's true of anything in the world, the more one-pointed we are, the faster the effects, the deeper the effects. Somebody wrote to Mahatma Gandhi, we agree with your non-violence. But he said, the practice of ahimsa, non-violence, satya, truth, and brahmacharya, self-control. Now many of the people did not like the idea of self-control. They were basically politicians, they were fighting against the British. The difference between Gandhi and the rest was, Mahatma Gandhi writes in his autobiography, My Experiments with Truth. He says, people think I'm a politician. People think I'm a freedom fighter, a social reformer. What I am is a simple man in search of God. He says that. All of that, he says, it's my spiritual practice for me. Now somebody wrote to him that, why not only ahimsa? Why other practices? Spiritual practices, it's religion, spirituality. Ahimsa is good politically. They understand it politically. They think he's doing politics. He is not doing politics. He is practicing a spiritual practice. He wrote back to them, very interesting. He says, you don't understand a simple truth. Ahimsa, brahmacharya, satya, non-violence, truth, self-control. They are very, very difficult, almost impossible if you practice them separately. Practice only brahmacharya and indulge in violence and untruth, you cannot protect it. Try to be truthful and don't practice brahmacharya, difficult to protect it. Try to be non-violent and we are not truthful, not self-controlled, cannot be non-violent. It's almost impossible to pursue any one of these separately. He says they are quite much easier, not easier, but they are all possible. It becomes humanly possible when you practice all of them at the same time. Can you please tell us the important verse, chapter and verse number? Okay, this is not clear. Some important verses you mean. Well, I've told you some today. As a high schooler going to college, my life seems filled with studying, tests and exams. I love God, so how do I find ways to practice Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga and Raja Yoga? Absolutely. What you are doing Can you transform that into spiritual practice? Do that work. If you are a householder, if you are a student, if you are a corporate executive, most of your time and energy will be in secular pursuits. And what Swami Vivekananda showed this time is, how can we transform our daily work into spiritual life? You can do it. But the beginning of reading a book or taking a test, you say this not for the sake of passing an examination. That's a secondary thing. Lord, you have put me in this situation. Now this is my worship. That's exactly what Arjuna said to Krishna. He says, my tests and studying and exams, Arjuna said, my fighting and all this will take up all my time. I don't want all this. I want to meditate and realize the Atman. Sri Krishna said, first you have to do this, convert it into karma yoga. You were doing karma. Earlier you were doing it for taking revenge on the Kauravas. You were fighting for dharma. You're trying to get do the righteous thing, getting your kingdom. Now you don't want it. Fine. But now you want to realize God. Very good. Now do your duty as a worship of God. Karma yoga. You can do that. I remember I was passing through Lucknow airport once, late in the night, and I was the only passenger in India. And the security people, like the TSA people, there were CISF people there. So the police officer was standing there. He looked at me and he said, I was wearing this dress. He said, Swamiji, kuch bataiye. Give us a lecture, a spiritual talk. In the airport. And in India, they'll make you stand on a little box and they'll frisk you. So I stood on the box and he called all the other police personnel there. Only 5 or 6 were present. It was midnight. And then I gave them a talk. Said, the question was, this work, how to make it spiritual? TSA agents work. So I said, it was UP. So I said, when you come out from home in the morning, do you worship Hanumanji? Hanumanji ka puja karte? He said, of course, bilkul karte. Yes, of course I do it. When I come, leave the house before that, I take a bath and I offer flowers at the feet of Lord Hanuman and come out. And I said, as the thousands of people filed in front of you and you check them, imagine each person is a flower. That thing you do is offering a flower at the feet of Lord Hanuman mentally. Do it to the best of your ability. Do it politely, firmly. Imagine that you are doing it. It's your job. But you are doing it as a worship of the Lord because the Lord has put you in this place. Mentally, nobody will see. Now his reaction was interesting. He's a huge guy with mustache, a bit like Yamada. He said in Hindi first, "Are Swami ji, din bhar Hanuman ji ka puja hoga. So I'll be worshipping God throughout the day." He said, "Yes, you can worship God throughout the day." And gave talks in the funniest of places. One talk was in an aeroplane. The flight purser suddenly came up to me and said, could you come back to the back of the aircraft? And Atma Priyanji was sitting there. And he got up and said, where are you going? What happened? He thought something was wrong in the middle of the flight. I went there and he had gathered all the air hostesses and all the seats were empty. And some of us stood and some of us, I sat and they stood around me. Purpose of life, 10 minutes, talk. So I gave a talk and came back and told our General Secretary, Swami Prabhanandaji. He burst out laughing. He said, I've heard of the Sermon on the Mount. It's a sermon in the air. You are sometimes told that in the problems that you face in life, life is trying to teach you a lesson or some lesson. How does one come to understand what lesson is that, what one has to learn in this present lifetime? Yes, we know what is right and what is wrong. And when we try to do it, what happens in the world and most important, our reaction in the mind is what teaches us. If I can't maintain my calm, the peace of mind, that's a good lesson to learn. Why I cannot do that? How can I do it better next time? If I cannot do good to others, I'm afflicted by envy or jealousy or hatred. It's a good lesson to learn. Don't worry about it. Those things come and go in the mind. You are the Atman. Now take the steps to purify the mind, to change the mind so that next time you do a little better. Life teaches us. They say, God is the little voice within us, conscience. If you listen to that, in Sanskrit it's called antaryami. The inner, literally it means inner controller. So God controls you through the voice of conscience. Our own idea of right and wrong. We have that. If we don't listen to it, then there is an external controller. And that external controller is the law of karma. In Gita they say, kala danda. The staff of time. That teaches us. The kicks and blows that we get from life are actually, they're teaching us. Where does the dream stage come within the steps that you described? I didn't talk about the dream stage today. I described one approach. In Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, there are Sanskrit word prakriya. The best word I can come up with in English is pedagogy. Procedures, algorithms. These are words I can come up with. They are meant to take you step by step to a realization of the self within. I used one and only one today. That is the method of the five sheets. Step by step to the one within. Method of the five sheets. There are other prakriyas. One prakriya is what you referred to here. Avasthatraya, the method of the three stages. Waking, dream, deep sleep. I'm speaking on that tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
That is exactly the subject tomorrow.
Exactly.
So that's another.
Have it tomorrow.
In the Sunday talk tomorrow here. So I did not talk about that today. And you? Talked?
You talk deep sleep being a beautiful.
Blissful.
A blissful stage, yeah. How do we know that if we are not.
How do we know that if you are not consciously aware of that stage? That's a standard answer. We know it. That's when we wake up, relaxed. That is the rationale. Yes, you got it right. Moment we wake up, our first reaction is Sukham Maham Aswapsam Nakinchid Avedisham. I slept happily. You know, I slept like a log, and I did not know anything. It was a restful state. See. It was not a state of experience of a particular joy. Like you're eating chocolate or something and you get a nice sensation. Not like that. It was the absence of all such sensations. But that in itself is a deeply restful state. So, one thing is nobody dislikes deep sleep. Everybody dislikes getting up from deep sleep. That's why the snooze button is there. The concept of Brahman oneness is very difficult to grasp. Does an entity have to be biologically alive for it to be considered Brahman? What about inanimate objects? What if those objects are created by humans? Are the creator and created one and the same? Where do we draw the line? Okay, barrage of questions. But, simple answer. Life, living, non-living, that's how we have learned in our school biology. But Advaita doesn't draw the line there. Life is the life sheath, pranamaya kosha. That's as much an object as the physical body or an inanimate. Life is also an object. It's a kind of process. There actually Vedanta very well agrees with modern science. It's a material process. Life is also a material process. But what Vedanta says extra, new, which is not there, which you have not yet come to, is that consciousness is fundamental. Again, the consciousness Vedanta speaks about is pure consciousness, not the consciousness which we experience or talk about in science, an involved intentional consciousness in the mind, not that. I used intentionality in the phenomenological sense. These are words only for philosophers. So if you are interested, you will know what I mean. Intentional consciousness is what we talk about in philosophy and psychology. Pure consciousness is Vedanta, is what Vedanta is talking about. Now, does it have to be biologically alive for it to be considered Brahman? Not at all. Biologically dead body is also Brahman. Only the life has departed from it. Living body is also Brahman. What about inanimate objects? Of course. See, why not? Existence, consciousness, bliss. Forget the consciousness, bliss part of it. Does an inanimate object exist? Yes. That existence is borrowed from Brahman. It's not conscious. Doesn't matter. It cannot be conscious because it does not have the subtle body. What we consider to be consciousness is a reflection. Remember, the face reflected in the mirror. You need a mirror for reflecting the face. You need a mind for experiencing consciousness. Even we, conscious beings, the moment we go into deep sleep, no experience of consciousness. The reflected consciousness goes away. Pure consciousness is still there. Pure consciousness is still there in the inanimate object. But if we do not, it does not experience consciousness within because it doesn't have a reflector, a mind, a mirror. So, what if those objects are created by humans? Yes. Because humans create objects only by taking objects available in nature. I'll end with this joke. Shiva in, Atma Tattvananda, he told this joke. He said, scientists went to God and said, we have created life in the laboratory. What great thing have you done? We have created life in the laboratory. God said, show me. The scientist said, come to my laboratory. So God went with the scientist to the laboratory. And the scientist said, well, first you take a little bit of earth. And God said, get your own earth.
One more little comment on this, that whether the so-called inanimate objects whether they are conscious or not. We may say that they don't have consciousness. Actually, the understanding that I have is that we do not have the instrument to detect their consciousness. They could very well have consciousness. In fact, Jagdish Chandra Bose showed that how they also respond to different signals like we respond. And therefore, they also are conscious. Manusmriti describes it very nicely that these things also have pleasure and pain. Antasadnya bhavantyete sukha-dukha samanvitaha. That these what we call inanimate, they also have the pleasures and pains if we have the sense to see it. It is not their inability, it is our inability to sense the pleasures and pains and consciousness there, and so we brand them inanimate. As one person said, you know, that at one point even women were supposed to have no consciousness. So extreme, you see. So
no souls,
yeah, it was like that. But everybody has this, everything is permeated with Brahman, and everything has a soul of its kind. Whether we are able to sense it or we are not able to sense it, that's different. So we have, friends, discussed all these, so many questions we extended. So again, thank you, Sarva Priyananji.